Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 1323.SS0701, certificate number 31961, the town of Bent Necks.
Und diesen Schuhdeal, den brauche ich schon gar nicht.
Du verzichtest auf den Schuhdeal?
Junge, was ist los mit dir?
Du spinnst.
Naja, vielleicht doch.
Do you have any sports loyalties?
Like to teams?
Yeah, or no, to, yeah, first to teams.
I'm loyal to the idea of sports. Yeah. I just want everyone to have a good time out there and maybe to get some good cardio in instead of sitting still, looking at their screens. That's what I'm loyal to. Don't want anybody to get hurt. I have a jersey that just says, I hope no one gets hurt.
And I have one that says, don't yell zero. At me. But what about style? What about sports style? We've talked before that I feel like you should not wear jerseys, sports jerseys, if you're not at a game or if you're not 5 years old. But how do you remember the tennis shoe wars of the late 80s, early 90s?
Those were funny because they seemed to be built largely on technology as much as aesthetics. You know, these are the sneakers that will have the gel in them that let you jump a little higher. These ones have the pump that will... Do you remember when sneakers had all these moving parts?
Oh, yeah.
And so some of it was like, well, which ones do Jordan wear? Which ones do, you know, Penny wear or whatever? But it very quickly became, you know, which ones have the latest space age polymers?
Do you remember kind of what point in your life that started to be part of the culture?
Yeah, that's mid to late 80s. A lot of my friends started to play basketball, so there was a lot of that. And I didn't care about sneakers, so I had the lame, like I had LA Gears.
Oh, yeah.
And they would just laugh at me. LA Gears, those are what Kareem wears.
Sure, British Knights.
Kareem's like 40. But I didn't really care that much. Like, we were living in Korea, so you could get knockoff whatever. You get, you know, Nikes that fell off a truck because they had a stitching error or something.
Right.
But my friends really wanted the real ones. They would go to the States and pay $200 for the new Jordans or whatever.
Was there any brand that you particularly identified with? Did you ever wear Ralph Lauren shirts or Fred Perry, black Fred Perry polos, anything like that?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
Well, even now, I mean, do you wear Levi's? Is there anything, any brand that you're like, yep, that's the one. I don't have to think about it.
I have some Levi's loyalty. I've got some pretty strong Uniqlo loyalty, but that's
pretty new.
More convenience than anything else.
Yeah, cheap and basically sized for a perfect medium
One-stop shopping. I'm going to get some socks. I'm going to need a windbreaker and
a suit and underpants.
Exactly. Yeah. They have it all. They can do it all.
And you never went through a Timberland phase or anything like that. I can't picture you in combat boots or really boots of any kind. Have you ever worn boots?
I don't think I even had a pair of Doc Martens at the height of having a pair of Doc Martens. Mindy has a pair of Doc Martens still that, you know, have survived intact because, of course.
Yeah.
All the Doc Martens are still... The future listeners are all wearing Doc Martens right now because they all survived the...
Doc Martens from the 80s.
They all survived the nuclear war, the atomic wars.
Well, you know, Doc Martin, I'm afraid, makes shoes overseas now. But what I have learned is that the Vietnamese Doc Martens are actually better than the ones made in England now. That's going to disappoint a lot of people to hear. But the shoe people, the people that like review shoes are like, yeah, the ones from Vietnam are actually pretty darn good.
I just don't like reading reviews because you'll feel bad about any product. Yeah, these Weber grills used to be pretty good, but then they replaced the whatever igniter with the whatever. And I'm just like, I guess I can't get that.
Nope, can't go back.
Tell me what to get.
Sure, you have to go back and buy the tungsten one.
Got to go back in time.
It's on Craigslist.
So no, but you do have a lot more brand awareness. I think a lot of it is that I have a philosophical objection to spending a lot of money on clothes. And yes. Honestly, it probably doesn't serve me well because maybe if I had just bought, you know, if I buy one well-made shirt, that would last me longer than a cycle of three Uniqlo button-downs.
Yeah, the Uniqlo shirts start to pill after the third wash and then... Yeah, the seams all come undone.
They break down into their component elements while you're wearing it.
Not to slag Uniqlo, but I have a lot of brand awareness because I buy my clothes at thrift stores. So as
you have to.
Yeah, as part of that, you know, as part of the challenge of wading through 600 shirts of different, completely different provenances, brands are one of the ways that you can kind of do a quick scan and go, oh, Uniqlo, I'm not going to linger here on this shirt because I know I can get it for $5 at the store. But if you see something that is from a brand that you know is like either in days past a premium brand or a department store brand or a brand you can't get anymore, I mean, all these things are clues that help you as you're sorting through kind of go, oh, I'm going to take a second look. And that's what thrifting is all about. It's that... if you've got 50 second looks that you're going to give 50 different things in this thrift store of 10,000 items, how are you going to put those 50 looks to work?
And you got to get fast and efficient. You got to have like the four leaf clover people. You got to know what you're looking for.
That's right.
I think I could get into that actually. I think I have the potential because I like browsing for things and I like rare finds.
Yeah.
I just don't have any, I never put in the time to actually learn what I was looking at when it came to clothes, whereas I can do it with old books, for example.
Yeah, exactly. The ability to go into a bookstore and scan and recognize, and then, you know, very quickly know, I'm going to take that one down and look at the title page.
Yeah.
And then the title page is going to tell you a lot about whether you want to keep going or not.
You can, your eye just becomes trained for it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I'm going to do in my 50s. I'm going to get really into Goodwill.
Well, and a lot of it is self-education, right? Because there's no manual, and no one ever takes you out. No one who knows thrifting is ever going to take you under their wing and say, let me show you how to find all the things
competition
right before I find them. But yeah, you learn, and I've got brands that in a thrift store I identify as like, oh, this is one of the brands that I search for. But that brand is still available today in real stores. You can buy them new. And I would never consider going into one of their stores and buying a new product.
Well, you're getting it for a third the price.
Well, a lot less than that. But also the idea, like you were saying, that the old ones were made out of tungsten and these new ones are made out of aluminum. That feeling that like Abercrombie and Fitch clothes from the 1950s and 60s are like absolutely top shelf. Abercrombie and Fitch clothes now are I wouldn't use them to pack a vase.
You mean, do you have to find ones that have survived well despite their age, or yes, are they so good that like any 60 year A&F shirt is better than a new one today?
Both things. I mean, anyone that has survived 60 years has been hanging in someone's closet. And, you know, the old man died and nobody cleaned out the house type of thing. Even if he wore it for 15 years,
It's still going to be in better shape.
It's still in better shape than something that's, you know, that's just made out of plastic thread. And
what if he spilled a lot of mayo on himself when he ate? Like, I'm asking for a friend.
Well, that's the thing. You flip. That's you're giving a second look to the shirt. It doesn't mean you're pulling it out and putting it in your Bastik. You stop and you look at it and you go, aha, I see. And then you have to tell whether it's a good one or not. Because a lot of them are, yeah, they've got mustard all over.
Are the cuffs frayed? Is there mustard on the front?
Right, right. It's harder to do with shoes. And the reason is that shoes just wear a lot worse. And shoes have people's stinky feet in them. But there are wonderful thrift store shoe finds. It's just not the first place you look. Because you're really, in a case like that, looking for a pair of shoes that were worn. Because there are plenty of shoes, and often it's the nice shoes that you only wear on rare occasions.
Yeah.
So you've got Grandpa's Aldens that he had custom made in 1950, and he only wore them 40 times in his life.
But work shoes or sneakers, good luck.
Yeah, and any shoe that's been made in the last 20 years is just going to crumble. But as you know and already said, the market for used Air Jordans, or especially old Air Jordans that haven't been worn, but even worn Jordans or tennis shoes of all kinds, you know, they command a pretty penny.
And my son went through a sneakerhead phase, I think, shortly before his vinyl phase, which was before his Pokemon phase. He's got some acquisitive stages where he would, you know, he knew what the nice shoes were, and you got to have one to rock and one to stock. And, but we checked it. We went down to Eugene to look at the University of Oregon, and we checked into one of these kind of university themed, alumni themed hotels, you know, and this was in Eugene. So there's a big duck in the lobby, and the whole front, the wall behind the cafe and the whole desk where you check in is nothing, but it's just Nikes wall to wall, because Eugene is track town and Phil Knight poured a ton of money into U of O, and my son's eyes just popped. And he's, you know, some of them are in good shape and some of them are not. But he was like, those are $80. Those are $880. Like, he knew just looking at these, you know, which were the nice shoes. And it seemed like he was maybe planning some kind of a heist.
Yeah, I bet he's not the first.
I don't want to give people ideas, but this hotel in Oregon seems like it has a lot of rare Nikes just. I guess
unguarded.
Well, it's not unguarded. What's less unguarded than a hotel check-in desk? It's the one place on earth where there's always somebody at 4 a.m.
Yeah, but the person that's at the check-in desk at 4 a.m., are they willing to risk their life just to guard against the 15 tennis shoes getting stolen?
You're posing a guy with a Nixon mask and a gun.
That's right.
I want to come in from the ceiling into an empty room, replace all the shoes with like clever counterfeits from my Korean childhood and be gone before anyone even knows. Like 20 years go by before they find out there was a heist.
You're just sneaking under those lasers in your super tight yoga pants.
I'm Catherine Zeta-Jonesing under lasers. Maybe that's what I should have done. I should have had some really high maintenance problem at the desk about how the pillows in the room are too soft. Soft and too hard. And meanwhile, Dylan's sidling under and getting the nice Jordans.
I remember, you know, I was in high school, junior high and high school, before the big sneaker craze, but sneakers were definitely on everybody's radar at that point. And part of it, I think my first awareness was the rise of Nike.
It's got to be Nike in America.
Because we're from the Northwest, and Nike is a Portland, Oregon company. And just the arrival of Nike on the scene and its transition or its evolution from and really quick evolution from being just a kind of shoe that was being made on a waffle iron by a kook to being a global phenomenon, it was pretty exciting because the Northwest was only known for lumber, fish, and airplanes.
And suicide.
And Portland was known for just lumber. It didn't even have fish or airplanes.
It didn't even have a suicide yet.
Do you mean suicide in the sense of all the pops put together at the roller rink?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I'm going to mix a suicide.
Yeah. We should talk about that someday, a graveyard / suicide / whatever the regional name you had it.
Yeah, I didn't know there were regional names.
Yeah, it's one of
but
those.
They're like, all death related.
Yeah,
it's ominous.
It's one of the identifiers.
Because what a way to go, right? Eating root beer that tastes like grape soda.
But in Atlanta, they still call it Coke.
It's what kind of Coke? Graveyard Coke.
Graveyard Coke. But so Nikes became very fashionable. But you know, we were I was the youngest boy in a tennis family, so I inherited a lot of Rod Lavers and sort of Adidas tennis shoes. And
they were called tennis shoes. My mom still calls them tennis shoes.
Or tenny runners.
Tennies.
Tennies.
We laughed at my mom when she said tennies.
Tenny runners, I guess, are tennis shoes that you can also run in because running was a new fad.
Nike had not yet invented the running shoe, which right. is funny for anybody younger than Gen X to understand.
Or in a weird way, invent running
right.
as a thing that you would go do.
Now that I've got these space age NASA shoes, I guess I could get over there a lot faster.
I mean, unless you were a British prep school student that was running on a beach in order to beat the 4-minute mile, why else would you go running?
Yeah. I guess Americans were still eating a diet that kept us like a jerky-like toughness.
Yeah, pork, and pork.
And it wasn't until we got enough high fructose corn syrup into our diet, from all the suicides at the roller rink, that we had to invent running.
Yeah, it was a fitness craze of the 70s, and Nike capitalized on it. But it was not until I was a freshman in high school that Nikes, those original sort of white Nikes with a red swoosh, became the shoe to have. And my mom would not pay the $80 or whatever they were.
All moms thought that was insane.
Insane money. And so she bought me the Stadia version at, the shoe locker.
That was your version of the LA Gears.
And it was before the sports locker. It was before, bought your sports equipment at either a sports store or the department store.
Go to Montgomery Ward to get you some tennies.
I had the white shoes with the little red whale that kind of looked like an upside down stripe, and it was not cutting it.
You got to run fast enough that people think it might be a swoosh or an Adidas stripe.
Right, right. And I did not run that fast. But the Nikes really dominated in those early days of high school.
I remember Reebok even being like kind of looked down upon.
Yeah.
Because it was not, I'm a little younger than you. Those were not Nikes.
No, and Reebok kind of had a reputation of being an aerobics shoe. Like that was a Jane Fonda shoe originally.
Mom shoe.
Yeah, and New Balance also. I think New Balance were considered pretty great shoes at first, and then they became like dad walk around the lake shoes.
I wear New Balance when I hike.
You're a dad, you walk around the lake.
That's my demographic.
Yeah. But when Adidas really arrived on the scene in my life, in my high school life, was with the simultaneous arrival of Run DMC. And Run DMC's real identification with Adidas shoes. They mentioned them in their tunes. They were a major part of their onstage costume. Run DMC dressed all in black with black Homburg hats and then white Adidas with black stripes, often with no shoelaces. And it was such an impact. The way they talked about the shoes as though it was without Adidas on, Run DMC wouldn't take the stage. And that just introduced into the world, I think, an awareness of a shoe brand being a thing that...
Brand as lifestyle.
Yeah, as lifestyle and as a way of communicating that, by wearing shell toes, you were saying something about what you listened to, who you were. It was a kind of colors, right?
It was... I wanted to confirm this. I thought that My Adidas was a single for them, and it was.
My Adidas.
It's a rallying cry.
It was, and it was, it began a whole association of shoes with hip-hop.
Probably came out of b-boy culture already.
Right. Breakdancing. I mean, originally hip-hop had no kind of fashion component. It was, it was about turf, and it was about... Lyrical. Style of rhyme.
Yeah, lyrical dexterity.
But then, the shoes added this whole other element to it. I remember wearing Timberlands a lot growing up, as and they were kind of just like waffle stomper or boat shoes. But then Timberlands became a big like fashion item in hip hop, and also like they were, I was in Europe one time and Timberlands were everywhere. Just Timberland brand was used as a, it was almost, it almost looked like a dollar sign the way it was used. Like people would sign their checks with like their name and then the Timberland logo. It was pretty weird.
Can you imagine Run DMC's eyes just popping out of their heads when they first got their first box of free merch from Adidas?
I know.
Because Adidas must have hooked those guys up once they realized what they were, how much product they were moving.
When we were on tour, we actually got invited to the, invited after hours to the Doc Martens store and told, you know, go around the store and take any two pairs of Docs that you want.
This pays for itself. Musicians wearing our stuff.
That's right. You guys are on, rock and roll on tour. So here you go. Pretty nice. You know, there's nothing better than swag. Really nothing better. Not a happy marriage. Not when your team wins the Super Bowl. Swag.
But it's got to be good.
Bag of free stuff.
Isn't most of the free stuff, most of the free stuff I get, I immediately just think, what am I going to do with this?
Well, yeah, because you get all the fleece jackets that are branded with whatever tech company you're speaking in front of. I think as you move further up in show business, like if you go to the Oscars, the swag bags are like, would you like a Rolex? Would you like these, you know, $2,500 shoes? Figures.
Not at that level. The people who need it the least, it should go the other way around. The swag should be the worst at the highest levels. That should be all the trade show stuff. Like, would you like a ballpoint pen that says the Oscars?
Yeah. Meanwhile, at Bonnaroo, they're giving all the bands Rolexes.
Exactly.
That'd be nice. That would be nice. Well, so the rise of Nike was pretty, had a pretty profound effect on like the sports clothes, sports gear universe. And Nike responded to the Adidas kind of hip hop connection by really making a strong connection culturally through basketball and through various other, you know, means to become kind of the dominant shoe of the sneaker collector universe.
Spike Lee did it. Thank you, Spike.
That's right. It's got to be the shoes.
He was right.
But you know, and so Nike now is the global leader in sports apparel, the largest sports apparel company by far. But until the 1980s, that wasn't true. And the second place sports apparel company in the world and the largest in Europe is Adidas, or Adidas. Adidas.
Named for, they say it that way because it was named for Adi Dassler. He, for some reason, after World War II, a lot of Adolfs went by Adi.
Yeah, well, Adi Dassler always went by Adi. It was a family nickname.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. And Adi Dassler was the youngest of four kids, born to a cobbler and his wife, who was a laundress. Who lived in Franconia, you know, a kind of like near to Bavaria in southern Germany.
We should still have cobblers.
Yeah.
Well, Phil Knight is a cobbler.
There were a couple of cobblers still in Seattle until very recently, and one of them got displaced up on Capitol Hill by the Uncle Ike's pot store. And there was such community outcry that, there were two competing pot stores across the street from one another, and one of them was going to kick out the old cobbler guy who was the son of the original cobbler guy. And I used to take my shoes to him. His store was just a mess. He couldn't believe that he could find anything. But he always fixed my shoes and did a great job because I would buy shoes at thrift stores that needed to be resold.
I guess, yeah, that's one corollary of everything getting junkier is the economy doesn't make sense to pay people to repair them anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the wonderful thing about buying a pair of shoes that are, you know, like some Cordovan shell shoes that last you for another 100 years if you put soles on them.
You were keeping that guy in business.
But Uncle Ike's pot shop, I think, made a little corner inside the marijuana store where this guy continues to repair shoes.
Oh, really?
As a kind of gesture to the community.
Maybe now at a much slower speed.
Yeah, or a much more iry speed. But Adi was the youngest of four kids who were, their parents were Christoph and Pauline Dassler, and their four children were Fritz, born in 1892, Marie, born in 1894, Rudy, short for Rudolph, mm-hmm. born in 1898, and then Adi, born short for Adolf, born in 1900.
They all dropped their Ulfs.
They dropped the Ulf, and that is that was a popular move, I think, even before the war. You know, Adolf Hitler calling himself Adolf, it was very formal.
Yeah, he should have gone by Adi. They might have won the war.
Adi Hitler. They're living in Herzogenaurach, Germany.
That doesn't seem very likely.
Herzogenaurach.
Do you think you ever, if you live in a place with a five-syllable name, do you ever say it, or do you think they just say round here?
I bet they say Herzy or Herzo. We'll probably hear from someone who will tell us. Herzogenaurach is the name of the town, and this will come up a lot because Herzogenaurach.
I'm so excited to say this a lot.
Herzogenaurach it ends up being the site of most of the rest of our story,
the titular town of our tale.
So the original Christoph kind of taught himself cobbling because his original profession, which was textiles, had kind of fallen out of favor in this region. They weren't a big textile manufacturer anymore, but shoes started to become a center of shoe manufacture. You know, shoe, I guess, in the 19th century, manufacture is probably a little bit of a big word. Shoes were still handmade.
Somebody and stitching them.
Yeah, custom made. But Christoph taught himself how to make shoes, and his wife took in laundry. And from an early age, Adi, the youngest, was kind of a sports-oriented kid. He liked to play all the different games. And watching his father make shoes, he had, you know, he just was kind of inspired to suggest innovations like, oh, you know, this would be much better for football if you put a little thing over the top. And, you know, his dad's making shoes for a living. He doesn't have time for this, you know, the shenanigans of his son. So his son kind of, Adi, gradually, you know, teaches himself the trade, although he's apprenticed as a baker. And it never showed any interest in baking.
It's a different kind of cobbler.
That's right. A delicious cobbler. But he kind of teaches himself the shoemaking trade. And is playful with it. And he doesn't even think of it as a trade. I think he was resigned to baking, but he's building shoes for himself.
It's a hobby.
Yeah, for his own kind of sporty, like, oh, what if I put, you know, this, that, and the other on top of these shoes? What if I strapped them down? What if I laced them this way or stitched them that way? And so he was, you know, always kind of innovating with footwear. And his other siblings didn't really take any interest in it, but it wasn't until around World War I when the older two siblings, Fritz and Rudy, got conscripted into the army. And of course, as we know, Germany lost. Adi went into the army right at the end. Didn't really see action. But they came back to their town, and there was an incredible famine of, well, not only of food, but of supplies. There was no leather available. There were no raw materials available at all.
Right.
And at this point, Adi kind of makes the decision to leave baking behind. And at the age of 19, starts a shoemaking company, and he's making shoes with found materials. He's basically taking the leather out of discarded military equipment. He's using rubber from old tires, and he's stitching together shoes. And he starts a company that is specifically making sports shoes. If you can think about, like, organized sports in the
pretty new, right?
1919. Yeah, these would have been, you know, sports were either the kind of the a distraction for the well-to-do, or the kind of hard scrabble street sports. But there wasn't, you know, a culture of sports in the same way. It was an aristocratic thing.
There was mountain climbing, and then there was everything else.
Not even mountain climbing didn't even really exist in the same way, unless you were.
What were they even playing? Tennis,
soccer.
They were already playing soccer.
Yeah, tennis, soccer. I guess. Yeah, like cat kicking, I think, was big at the time. His company was called Sportfabrik Gebrüder Dassler. Mm-hmm. And it was they shortened it to GEDA. And he started making shoes. And at that point, his brother Rudy, his older brother, older by 2 years, joined the company. And the two of them kind of, you know, burbled along making shoes. And again, spending time with Adi as the creator and Rudy as the salesman, trying to get their shoes into the hands of people that were playing sport as a you know, making sort of innovative shoes out of different kinds of material.
It's funny. There's a Wozniak and a Jobs already. There's, yeah. There's like one of them who knows how to knows the product and the other one who's into the relationship.
Yeah. The engineer and the salesman. And they partner with a local, you know, a local metalsmith, and they get him to make little spikes that they attach to the bottom of the shoes. And they're the first football shoe. They're the first spikes.
They invented those cleats, huh?
Yeah, the first cleats, basically. But it's really in the 1930s where they start to kick into gear. And that's where Adolf Hitler really comes into the picture, because the brothers recognize in the rise of the Nazis, that there is a new focus, a new emphasis on sport as a way of
the young fit Aryan youth.
That's right.
That's the future of Germany.
Expressing your nationalism through like this hale and hearty, pink-cheeked sport. And so both brothers joined the Nazi party in the very early 30s, so only weeks after Hitler is released from prison.
Yikes.
And they partner with the Hitler Youth and begin making sports shoes and basically profiting from the, you know, the Nazi interest in health and outdoorsmanship.
I wonder if they're holding their nose like a lot of, you know, it's not like German liberals at the time didn't know what Hitler was, or are these guys like true believers, like this is the way forward for the country? Are they hopeful, or are they just trying to sell more exercise gear?
Well, this comes up a lot later, after the war in particular, because this gets adjudicated a lot, and it was a big feature at the end of the war in the Truth and Reconciliation around Nuremberg trials, where the U.S. Army and the United, you know, the Allied attempt to bring Nazis to justice meant that there were all these, you know, local tribunals on these topics. But also the Americans pretty quickly realized that if they were going to prosecute every Nazi in
every
Germany,
manufacturer, yeah,
you know, it wasn't going to work. And so part of the Marshall Plan was to exonerate a lot of people that maybe should have done a little bit more in terms of reparation for their crimes. But so, the sense is that that this was, and certainly the story that that Adi told later was that yes, it was just a matter of expedience. He never was a true believer.
Good business.
Michael, it was only business.
Right.
But they And there's some evidence in the sense that as he tried to get his shoes into the hands of sports people, Adi recognized, and Rudolf recognized, I think, as the marketer, that the 1936 Olympics were going to be an incredible opportunity for them to get their shoes in front of the world. And
they should have put them on Jesse Owens, it turned out.
And they did put them on Jesse Owens.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they went to Jesse Owens and as far as the story goes, silently handed him a pair of their sort of revolutionary GEDA shoes. And Jesse Owens wore them. and wore them to victory.
I mean, so, I guess that's pretty good evidence that they're really just more interested in advancing their own business than they actually were in Nazi ideology. If they're okay with everybody having the same shoes.
Yeah. It came into play after the war, the fact that they had supplied shoes to Jesse Owens, because it was a mitigating.
A true believer would have kept their shoes just for the Aryan team.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And somehow sneaking over and handing them to Jesse Owens didn't attract the attention of Hitler until after the fact.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Adi was... as part of his interest in making shoes as a hobbyist and as an enthusiast, he actually went to the Footwear Technical College in Germany, which...
The FTC?
Which was a... Well, in Germany, it's called the Schuhfachschule.
Huh.
So, Schuhfachschule.
There's like a national how to make shoes school.
There was. And he... One of his teachers was a man by the name of Franz Martz. And he was an expert in the construction of lasts, which are the kind of wood models that you build a shoe around. And Franz's daughter, Kathy, how do you pronounce that in German? Kata?
Maybe short for Katarina. So yeah, it probably is Kata.
It's Kata. Kata became Adi's wife in 1934. And she was, by all accounts, an outspoken and undaunted young woman. She was just a teenager when they married. But her introduction into the family became kind of a big part of the story, because she was a young woman who was fairly contentious. And even though the shoe company was having success, Christoph and Pauline and Adi and Rudy, and both Adi and Rudy's wives and all 5 of their subsequent kids lived in one house together. And Katya did not get along.
She's a troublemaker.
She was a troublemaker. She was opinionated. She got involved in the business and wanted, you know, and her opinions and her suggestions were taken seriously by Adi. And so this is the story that Rudy tells later as he describes the causes of his estrangement from Adi.
It does seem... easy to scapegoat the woman there and make her out to be the Yoko of Adidas.
And there and within the story, there's also a feeling of that the two wives, Rudy's wife and Katya, also did not
get along.
They just didn't get along, and there was. But you know, I think a big part of it is that all these people are living in one house. Move out, move to another house. That would be nice. You can afford
it. They seem a little Lebensraum.
Yeah, get a little. Get a little love nest somewhere. Come on, you got a new bride, like a couple of new kids. You don't want to live with grandma and grandpa.
Presumably the business is doing okay.
These are small towns too. It's not clear why they all had to live in the family Schloss. Hmm. But that's how it panned out. But the disputes between Rudy and Adi started before the war. Your brother joined us at a baseball game the other day, and he seemed like a sweet guy.
He was in town with us. He's probably listening to this right now. So,
do you and your brother have any kind of? Can you imagine a situation where you and he would become estranged? Is he somebody who would bring something who would say to you, like, I refuse to eat in your kitchen anymore because you don't have a separate set of plates for the chocolates?
I hope not, because we get along great.
He's a sweet fellow.
But he does have kind of some dogmatic ideas. You know, he will, if he decides, you know, I don't do this, he will never do that again. He will never take such a vacation or... He has like a 5,000 CD collection, but he has very specific rules. You know, no matter how much he loves the artist, if the CD has fewer than 9 tracks, I think it is, he will just not refuse to own it.
What if it's a 65-minute long record, but only has 9 tracks?
Even worse, you know, six long tracks, that's just self-indulgent. That's not what he wants.
Oh.
Just doesn't fit the collection.
He believes that a record is 9 songs.
At least.
What if it's a 9-song record, but it's only 29 minutes long?
He has a minimum length too, I think. It might be like 38 minutes.
This is weird because this actually comes up in indie rock record label conversations. What constitutes, what makes a record more than an EP?
Well, sure. There's the possibility of looking lazy. You're charging the same amount for the shorter musical selection.
The first Long Winters record only has 9 songs, but there's a unlisted track. There's actually 10 songs, and the track is unlisted because we weren't sure about the copyright. It's a cover. We weren't sure who held the copyright, and we didn't want to deal with it, so we just put it on there without any attribution. And so it's a 10 song record, but your brother would have looked at it on the shelf and thought it was a 9 song record.
No, he would know.
Yeah, that's right.
He has an encyclopedic knowledge of indie rock.
So but you don't think he would stop being your friend or become estranged from you if you were like, I have a record collection of only 29 minute records.
If I bought a Roxy Music album that only had 32 minutes of music on it.
Yeah.
No, he would overlook that. We actually get along great. We have a lot of interests in common. So there's nothing strained between us. But, you know, I can see how family members do fall out, you know, especially when they're inflexible. When one makes it a rule of life that I'm not going to put up with your crap anymore. And for many people, that's a healthy decision.
Right. In the case of these two brothers, Rudy and Adi, there was a lot of contentiousness and it takes, I think, mostly the form that Adi's the youngest brother, but clearly the inspired one. And with his wife, Katya, he believes and they believed that he was the founder of the company and should be in charge. And Rudy seems much more like a glad hander and also believed that as the older brother, it should be, although the company founded by his younger brother, that he should be the one in charge, just at primogeniture.
And that was probably even more pronounced then, idea that, you know, the family business belongs to the oldest child.
And there seems to be some parental favoritism.
Oh.
Pauline ended up in the long run siding with Rudy.
Does each parent have a favorite? This is always fun.
It seems like they did, although Christoph seems like he may have stayed above the fray. But going into the war, they're both members of the Nazi party. But weirdly,
that's nice that they have that to talk about.
Well, and I think their older brother too, Fritz, also joined.
It's good to have common interests.
It is. It's nice. And I think it brought Nazism brought the family together.
For whatever else you can say about Nazism.
But going into the war, there was not, you would expect that the German war machine would say, let's convert your...
Yeah, make some boots.
Yeah, factory to some cool, you know, if not like marching boots, then cool commando like Spider-Man boots. But that turned out not to be the case. And they...
Maybe that made the difference in the war. Maybe if
they had made Adidas Spider-Man boots.
The Germans had just had Adidas boots.
They certainly had
all day I dream
bear
about
aspirin.
All day I dream about Sudetenland.
it turned out that Rudolf was conscripted and the company was kind of shut down and machines were moved in and it was put to work as a manufacturing plant for, you know, initially for Woojits and Flibbity Gibbets.
The older kid got drafted, but not the younger.
The older kid got drafted and went into what after the war was suggested was kind of a like an SS style intelligence unit.
Yikes.
Although all of this, again, sort of disputed by conflicting testimony at the end of the war. Eventually, Adi retools the factory, and the Adidas factory, or what would soon be Adidas, but the Gaeta factory, starts manufacturing bazookas.
Can you use the same machines? Do you think Phil Knight will ever discover that he could just turn his sneaker machines around and make bazookas?
And make bazookas. The bazooka had not... Bazooka was an American invention, and it was only when they started capturing American bazookas that they reverse engineered them. And so, you know, Adi was in the bazooking making business.
It's bazooking. That's the
bazooking.
They spent the word bazooking.
They ended up making almost 100,000 bazookas before the end of the war.
Wow.
But at the end of the war, there was a lot of contention. Rudy was captured. The American tanks rolled in. And
rolled into where?
They rolled into...
To what was the name of the place they rolled into?
Herzogenaurach. And there's this kind of dramatic story that the tanks rolled into the town and they were just kind of like pointing their cannons at anything that looked like a part of the war effort and just blowing up buildings run after
are
the other.
Are these Russians? Where's this town?
No, these are Americans because this is Bavaria.
Okay.
At which point, Katya ran out and stood like Tiananmen Square, stood in front of a tank and said, no,
don't destroy our bazooka factory. I mean, shoe plant.
Don't destroy our shoe plant because we are innocent. And I think might have even said, we gave shoes to Jesse Owens in the 36 Olympics. And somehow the American soldiers, didn't destroy the factory, turned their cannons away and went on down the road, destroying other factories.
Wow.
And the American...
Every other factory is like, we gave some of these crackers to Jesse Owens. He said they were good.
We gave some of these bazookas to Jesse Owens. Holy cow. They actually, I guess, billeted the American officers there in Schloss Dessler.
They know which side their pretzel's buttered on, these guys.
That's right. And there were... in the Nuremberg fashion, like everybody's got a tone or at least a count for their performance in the war. And there's all this record, public record of them all being Nazis and public facing
and making
Nazis.
Bazookas for the war.
Yeah. And Rudy actually being, you know, arguably a Zonderkommando a bad actor.
He's got a black leather jacket in the closet.
But they make the case that they are, you know, kind of essential to the, shoes being a non-political thing. You know, they're kind of, they're ready to play a part in the rebuilding of Germany. And eventually the Americans realize we can't prosecute every Nazi in this country. And
everybody was making something for the war machine.
Yeah.
Right.
And so they, you know, they absolve them of their involvement, but the damage between Adi and Rudy is done. And part of it was during these trials, they kind of denounced one another, or actually did denounce one another. And, and Adi said Rudy was a bad Nazi. And Rudy said, he was making bazookas. Are you kidding me?
His name's literally Adolf. And the Americans couldn't decide who to believe. So they... Yeah. Let them both go. It's pretty smart.
They let them both go. At which point, their shoe company, they decided to split in half. Rudy was going to leave.
One does left shoes, one does right shoes.
If only. Rudy and Adi, the way that they worked it out was that the people that were in sales and marketing and administration, they allowed their employees to pick who they went with.
Oh, interesting.
And sales, marketing, and administration all went with Rudy because they worked with him and trusted him and liked him. And all of the engineers and manufacturing people stayed with Adi. And that was the larger portion of the company. Adi kept the original factory, and Rudy went across the river in the town of Herzogenaurach.
Herzogenaurach. I think you said like Herzogenaurach. You really hit the O before.
Herzogenaurach. Oh, just saying it is making me cough. Right through the center of Herzogenaurach is the river Arak. And Rudy took his people across the river and built a new factory.
It's very biblical. Oh,
no, I'm sorry. There were two factories that were part of this this company.
Oh, okay.
And Rudy took the south factory, and Adi kept the north factory.
This is a Steinbeck novel. These two brothers fighting, and one of them crosses the river with his people, shaking his fist.
Yep.
And but they stayed in this. It's interesting. They stayed in the same town.
The same
as rivals and what.
Bitter enemies.
Embittered brothers, yeah.
Rudy initially called his shoes Ruda.
Sure.
Short for Rudy Dessler.
And it was, the other was called, it was called Gaeta originally, right?
Gaeta originally. Adi went from, Adi called the shoes Adas, but there was already a brand of children's shoes called Adas, so he just put an I in, you know, Adidas.
Adidasler.
And the evolution of Ruda to Puma was kind of just, I mean, Puma just is a badass cat, whereas Ruda just sounds like, you know, somebody's
like is this the first time
aunt.
We're revealing that Rudy's shoes go on to become Puma?
Ruda became Puma. Mm. Yeah, Rudy shoes. Rudy do.
Rudy Tootie, fresh and fruity.
And the two companies begin what became a rivalry throughout the 20th century, and a rivalry where it basically divided the town. Anyone who lived on the south side of town also worked in Rudy's factory and only wore Puma shoes, and anyone who lived north of the river worked north of the river and wore Adidas.
This is insane. It's a company town, but it's divided between two companies that are just totally estranged and hate each other.
And it was a not just a neighborhood thing, but a family thing. If your father worked for Adidas, you worked for Adidas. It never would occur to you to wear a Puma shoe. If there are people that you know that said that you would never mention the name of the rival across the river.
Oh, you can't even say it.
And the town was called, became nicknamed the town of bent necks because the first thing you did was look at someone's shoes and that would tell you everything about them.
It is literally gang colors.
Yeah. So you're walking around, you know, you can't really interact in the town without looking down first. So the town of bent necks became its nickname, and I think only recently it stopped being kind of known that way in the region. Their success throughout the 50s and 60s was very connected to sport. The first World Cup after the war, the Germans weren't allowed to participate in. In 1950, there was still, you know, Germany was still an occupied country. And you
did a very naughty genocide. You cannot be in the World
Cup. You're not allowed to play football. But by 54, there was a kind of rehabilitation happening. West Germany, I think everybody saw that trying to keep the Germans beaten down didn't work after World War I. And maybe the way to do it after World War II is just get them back in the game and turn them into healthy, happy capitalists.
Is that still a unified German team, or is it it's a West German and an East German team, I guess?
At the time, this would have been the West German team. They were allowed into the 1954 World Cup, and Adidas became the official shoe of the German team. Now, both Adi and Rudy were really at the forefront of the idea of sports marketing, and Rudy was really good at it, but Adi had all these friendships and relationships, connections to people in sport because he was making the shoes and was, and people came to him to find out about the shoes. The coach of the West German team was a man named Sepp Herberger, and Sepp had also been a Nazi, but that wasn't what they had in common. What they had in common was a love of shoes. And so Sepp became he was the one that chose Adidas to be the shoes of the German team. And from that, from 1954 all the way into the late 70s, the competition between the brothers had a lot to do with, you know, what evolved into sports marketing, wasn't a thing.
I assume Adidas had a jump in the shoe game since they actually had all the real engineers and designers working for them.
They had better shoes, right?
But Sepp knows what he's doing.
But Rudy was a better marketer. And in the end, it was at the 1970 World Cup that Rudy got Pelé into Pumas. Mm. And as part of the contract, Pelé, at the start of the game, ran out onto the pitch and held his hand up to the referee who was about to blow the whistle to start the game and bent down and tied his shoes on camera in front of, you know, a billion people watching the World Cup. And this was like a little buzz marketing that Rudy came up with.
Must have been controversial at the time. Like now it's just commonplace that there will be sneaker wars as part of every professional sport.
I think that it was only later revealed to be, it was just like, oh, hang on, I've got to tie my shoes.
Got to tie my Pumas.
And so the camera pans down to, you know, to capture Pelé there tying his shoes. And it's just up to you if you want to see what shoes he's wearing, if you want to buy those for yourself.
You don't have to bend your neck if the camera's bending it for you.
But it is true that that Adidas always had the lead in terms of technological innovation, and they always were the biggest company. And it actually was Adi's son, Horst Dassler, who really took sports marketing to the next level. And in the 1970s, began aggressively pursuing
athlete endorsements, and
not just athlete endorsements, but sports sponsorships. So he was responsible for Coca-Cola being the supporter of the 1980 or the 1976 Olympics.
Oh, wow.
So he got into the game, you know, outside of Adidas entirely.
Because that's been so good for sports to have big business in it. Thank you, Horst.
And Horst was the first one, the first one to make the Olympics profitable. And Horst sadly died at a young age, and by young age I mean my age. And both of the brothers, the older brothers, died in the late 1970s. That did not end the feud, because it had become generational, and so throughout the 80s and 90s, there was still this tremendous, you know, personal animosity and personal divide within the city.
It's just crazy. It would be like if McDonald's and Burger King were both headquartered in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, or just some little tiny place. I don't know. Are there two American companies that really hate each other? Coke and Pepsi are both in Atlanta.
Yeah, right. Across the river from one another.
Yeah.
Adidas did build a big factory plant in Portland, Oregon, and their headquarters is just right down the either right up or right down the hill from Nike.
You know, that happens a lot.
I think like down the hill.
You see it in Seattle with all the big tech companies just wanting to fire a shot across Amazon's belt. We're not going to not have an office in Seattle. So Google and whoever will put in offices just right next to Amazon as if to say, yeah, we're here too.
We're here too. We're going to go down to, we're going to make the Vivace coffee as crowded as possible so you can't enjoy it. The three-stripe logo was, I think, a big part of how Adidas was instantly recognizable, you know, everywhere they appeared.
Where did the stripe start?
The stripe logo, actually, I think Adidas came up with it, or Adi came up with it independently, but it actually had been patented by the Finnish sports company Karhu, which you still see. Their logo now is like a bear on the prowl. Mm-hmm. And they make all kinds of sports gear, but they had the copyright on, or the trademark of the three stripes, and Adidas bought it from them, kind of like Manhattan Island. They gave them some beads and two bottles of Aquavit.
Was that kind of their invention, or like an easy to recognize logo on athletic gear?
I mean, they make shoes too, and I think that the Adidas stripes came about as a result of there were already straps in those locations. And Adi was like, well, why don't we make the straps a different color and people will be able to see it? And it was only, when they discovered that, no, that was a, that that copyright was already held.
It's so funny that it would have to be, of course it makes sense. You know, most kinds of shoes to this day do not have big logos on them. When I wear a pair of loafers, it doesn't have a big business school designed logo on the side.
Right. But you could have a pair of loafers that had a different, like a signature color of laces.
Sure.
The yellow laces of Preppy Loafer Company.
It just seems so crazy to imagine a world where athletic shoes did not have some huge, instantly identifiable symbol or color scheme.
What's nuts about Herzogenaurach?
We'll just say it differently every time, and no one can complain.
Is that the whole town was branded this way. The manhole covers on either side had the logos on it.
This seems like they're almost embracing it as kind of a fun local oddity.
It would have been great if it was fun, but it wasn't fun. It was like Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland.
It was Belfastian. To put a different symbol on different utilities.
Yeah, they sponsored two separate football clubs from the town. And it was only in the 90s, and I think they credited the IPO. Adidas only had an IPO in 1995, and that was the end of family control of the company. Yeah. There were certainly Desslers still involved, and they were the grandchildren of the Desslers who had grown up not knowing their cousins, not allowed to fraternize, never having met them. But gradually with the passings of the generations and the fact that both companies became massive global conglomerates, at present, Adidas has 57,000 employees and 21 billion euros a year in earnings. Puma employs 13,000 people and has 5.5 billion euros in revenue.
But they're both still headquartered just a few miles from each other?
Headquartered there? Literally across the river from one another. Now, it's still true that everyone in the town wears one or the other. You would almost never find anyone that that wore clothes across that crossed the stream, except now it's considered good-natured, except the mayor, a man interestingly named German Hawker.
German Hawker?
German Hawker is the mayor.
It's a little on the nose.
He makes a point, although he grew up, I think, in Puma, on the Puma side, he makes a point to always wear an item from both companies whenever he does a public appearance as a way of, bringing peace to the valley. Is there a version of that here on the Omnibus between the two of us? Is there a way that someone could express? Because there's a lot of fan loyalty. People are Ken fans. People are John fans. Although Futurelings tend to be pretty ecumenical.
Yeah, they can ecumenic all day.
Is there a way that a Futureling could heal the wounds by wearing an item that was identifiable with each of us?
Yeah, you could wear like a Filson. Do they make flannel stuff? They just make leather goods.
No, they make flannel stuff.
You could
stuff,
wear a Filson shirt with a pocket protector in it. And that's how you bring the piece back to Omnibus. And that concludes the Town of Bent Necks, entry 1323.SS0701. Oh, SS. That's, I didn't even notice how weird. Appropriate that was. Certificate number 31961 in the Omnibus. Now, as you know, probably you've heard this before. In your time, global information networks have collapsed, but we lived on ours. I'll tell you what.
I once did, but not now.
I hated to look up from my screen and see what was going on in real life. I was a real screenager, as we say.
Lol. Did you see my new phone? It's as big as a paperback book. Look at that thing.
I don't like the big phones. No, I keep buying the smallest phone Apple makes, and they keep making the smallest phone bigger and bigger.
I know. Well, I'm a big man and I watch a lot of porn. So yeah, I'm going to have the big phone. Sure.
Yeah. If you want to show your allegiance to John, just buy the t-shirt that says, I'm a big man and I watch a lot of porn. You can wear that everywhere. You can wear that to church. As a result, in our time, we were at the at Omnibus Project on Twitter and elsewhere. I'm at Ken Jennings. John is at John Roderick. That's principally on his own Patreon, the real Patreon, the one true Omnibus Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/omnibusproject. If you enjoy the show and wish to support it, the show only exists through the devotion and generosity of a small coterie of listeners. Mm-hmm. Maybe one in 20 or 1 in 25. There's some room to grow there.
There is a lot of room to grow, and I think, you know, when we talk about the Patreon, we're communicating to that group that's on the fence, that group that feels like, you know, I've been meaning to support Ken and John on Patreon, but I haven't gotten around to it. Or
we're not talking to you who already support.
Yep,
we love you. We're not talking to you who have already decided not to because you're awful freeloaders.
Yeah, we're hoping to reach
the swing voter.
Yeah, the soft middle who says, you know, I just have never gotten around to that, or it seems hard to sign up. Or
I always hear them talking about it on the show, but then when I'm in front of a computer, I forget.
Yeah, I could give them $5 a month. What is that? That's hardly anything. I spend more than that on gum. And I get a lot more enjoyment out of Omnibus than I do out of a piece of gum, let me tell you.
Well,
it's,
I mean,
for you.
A piece of gum costs less than $5 a month. It would have to be the joint, the aggregate happiness you get from all your monthly gum chewing, which could total upwards of $5, mm-hmm. I'm sure. But how good can that be? Like, if you total each stick of gum you chew, it's still a pretty mild pleasure. Nothing like the deep insights and belly laughs that come from each and every hour of Omnibus.
Mm-hmm.
Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and acquaint yourself with some of the benefits that come with membership. You can find other like-minded listeners by searching for The Futurelings on Facebook and Reddit and elsewhere. You can email us your objections to anything we said about National Socialism, which we oppose. Mm-hmm. Send that to theomnibusproject@gmail.com. I will clarify by responding to all these objections by saying John and I, in fact, oppose National Socialism.
We are against Nazism, not just now, but since the dawn of the show. Even before.
What about the fashion? Do you like the long coats?
No.
We don't like anything about them.
No, there's nothing. I can't support any. That's why I don't wear Hugo Boss.
We don't like we don't like Volkswagen.
I never take.
We don't like Adidas
aspirin.
Or Puma.
Nope. I only wear American shoes.
We don't like Siemens.
No. We do not like them on a train. We do not like them on a plane.
We don't like
Mercedes-Benz or Porsche.
A little narrow mustache, no. Even on the other guy from Sparks.
If you he's pretty cool. But if you gave me a Porsche, I would drive it, but under duress.
I would drive it just into a wall.
Ha!
To show my disdain.
No.
For its fine German workmanship.
But I very much support the great works of the nation of West Germany and now the unified Deutschland, where there's no one really alive anymore that was a Nazi, or hardly any, and everyone else is newly born.
You can't cast Christopher Plummer or Max von Sydow in your movies anymore to play the old Nazi guy, because not only are they dead, all the old Nazis would be dead.
That's right. So you have to, your new movie has to have the sons of Uruguayan Nazis. And sure, we could write that screenplay in an hour.
Or depressingly, any of the modern white supremacist options.
Yeah, right. Anybody that listens to political talk radio.
You could also send physical items, although not German-made ones, apparently, to the Omnibus Project at our P.O. Box, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. I had forgotten that we received this postcard from Maine. It's postmarked from New Orleans, but it's from Acadia National Park. So apparently one of the original Acadians has returned to Louisiana to send us this postcard. And although the front shows the high surf pounding on Otter Cliffs on the main coast, the postcard itself has only this cryptic message: Signaterra fish poisoning.
Huh?
In the Bahamas and through the West Indies, fishes on the steep windward side of a small island may be highly toxic, while those on the shallow leeward side may be perfectly edible. No signature, no explanation.
Wow, okay.
Just a seafood tip from the West Indies. It's addressed to us, but the address is taped on, and if you lift it up, this was actually headed to Gainesville, Florida. Somebody in Gainesville was about to get this seafood-related warning.
Why did our names get taped over? This gets weirder and weirder all the time.
This is my favorite postcard.
But wait, is there a name of the people in Gainesboro?
No, that's also just an address. from Gainesville, Florida.
But in the same handwriting as the rest of the...
Yes, it's the same hand. Maybe it was a postcard that was going to be used as a vacation postcard to friends in Florida, and then it got addressed but not written on, and when it got repurposed as an omnibus postcard, it needed this little leaflet taped on the top.
Does it look like it's been canceled by the post office, not canceled by Twitter, more than once? Is it possible that this was sent a long time ago and someone has repurposed it?
I think it's only been canceled once.
Wow. Just like me?
Just like so many of us.
Just like you. That's right.
There's a... Maybe that's a suggestion for a show on why you should only eat fish from the windward, from the leeward sides of the Caribbean, of the Antilles. I'm not sure, but thank you, anonymous sender. Please let us know. Let us know if you. We would love to credit you for sending us this mysterious postcard.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.